The issue is it needed to be competitive in the marketplace? Is it needed to retain talent and recruit new talent in the organization? Is it needed to set you up for success in the future? And these are the kind of questions that if you don't answer yes to these, then you need to reconsider why it is you're changing in the first place.
This is the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nessel & Associates, a Newport Beach, California-based ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. The ERP OCJ seeks to share expertise, insight, experience, and research, and to create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success. And now, here's your co-host, Jonathan Donald, founder of the change management firm Invert Ventures, and your ERP expert and host, the founder of Nessel & Associates, Dr. Jack Nessel.
On today's episode, we will discuss leveraging organizational change with Jake Jacobs. This episode, we will further examine how change is beneficial to organizational performance, stakeholder ownership, participation, and a major influence on realizing effective and efficient changes. Mr. Jacobs is a best-selling author of 3 books, including the book we're going to discuss today, Leveraging Change, 8 Ways to Achieve Faster, Easier, and Better Results. Jake's other works include Real-Time Strategic Change, How to Involve an Entire Organization in Fast and Far-Reaching Change, and Collaborating for Change, Real-Time Strategic Change, with co-author Frank McCowan. And You Don't Have to Do It Alone, How to Involve Others to Get Things Done, with his co-authors Richard Axelrod and Emily Axelrod and Julie Bidon. Mr. Jacobs is also a contributing author on what I consider one of the best change books and critical resources called The Change Handbook. It's the definitive resource on today's best methods for engaging whole systems. And that book is edited by Steve Caddy and Peggy Holman. Jake is also the CEO and founder of Jake Jacobs Consulting, a global consulting firm specializing in helping organizations create fast and lasting results, and is clearly a process-focused change leader who I'm excited to have on the podcast today. Jack?
I am too. Thanks, Jonathan. Appreciate it. So, although enterprise resource planning systems can deliver a powerful business advantage, considerable evidence suggests that, in general, ERP organizational change efforts often significantly underperform against preconceived expectations. ERP organizational change is often a complex and dynamic interaction among employees, business processes, and technology. However, although ERP organizational change continues to be a common and significant corporate project, the challenges can be significant. ERP organizational change is defined as an organizational change process in which business systems and technologies are upgraded or installed to bring improved, additional, and effective business intelligence and operational support to an organization through utilizing ERP systems. In other words, implementing ERP systems is a significant organizational change endeavor. Let's gain some more organizational change insight from our next guest. Jake is a thought leader in the space of successful organizational change. In this episode, we are delighted to have Jake with us today as he shares tactical and practical insight into making any organizational change endeavor easier, faster, and more effective. Jake will share with us how to design your own customized change process, create real energy for change, and strike the right balance between explicit direction and creative collaboration. We're going to discuss how to make change work as a part of people's regular routines. Joining us from Toledo, Ohio, Jake, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Thanks again for your time and really looking forward to picking your brain here. First, Jake, please tell us more. Please introduce yourself to our listeners.
Sure. I've done consulting work around change in organizations for the past 35 years, and my clients really fit one of 3 descriptions. They're either frustrated that their change efforts are taking too long, they're too hard, or they're ineffective. They don't work at the end of the day. And so all of my work is around large, complex efforts, similar to ERP implementations, where there are multiple stakeholders, with common but very often competing needs. And so those tough changes, resistance, pressure on timelines, those are my sweet spot of where I work.
Jake, I have a big smile on my face because that's an area I spend a lot of time thinking about. I want to focus in a little bit more on your book. And you've written a few, but today we're talking about Leverage Change, 8 Ways to Achieve Faster, Easier, Better Results. So given your experience in change and in this space, why did you decide to specifically write this book? Who's it for? And what do you hope they get out of it?
Sure. I mean, who this is for are the people that I was just describing. So people who lead change work in organizations that are interested in achieving results faster, easier, and better. And I would go one further and say with fewer resources. So you'll get more by investing less. And that's really the concept behind leverage. And why I say fewer resources is because you're going to spend a lot less time spinning wheels, falling short of milestones, and going down dead ends in terms of investment of time and talent and money. That's going to be available for you for other parts of your business. And so why I wrote this book, I've distilled 35 years of that work that I've done into these 8 smart strategic actions, which I call levers because of that concept of leverage. And that came from a quote that I heard a long time ago and still believe to be true. It was by a man named Archimedes, who was a Greek mathematician in the 3rd century BC. And your listeners may be saying, why are we talking about a mathematician from the 3rd century BC? That's a fair question. But he said something in describing leverage that I think is absolutely critical. And what he said was, and some people may be familiar with this, give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum on which to place it, and single-handed, I shall move the world. And so I've come to believe that people can move their worlds in the arena of change by applying these levers. And for so many people, change has been difficult. It's been stressful. It's energy sapping, anxiety producing. Like people hear change in organizations, and it's usually not a celebration. And I wrote this book because I know that there are better ways for organizations to go about this. And by changing our paradigms and changing the way we think about making the future happen, we can, in fact, make that happen faster, easier, and better.
So, Jake, just a quick follow-up on your points there. So you're an organizational change expert. You're a thought leader, author, and practitioner. But is change always good? In fact, change can be extremely risky, right? And why or should organizations embrace the change anyways? I mean, if life is good, then why not just maintain status quo, right? You just said yourself, it's highly disruptive and a significant challenge.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. And, you know, there are organizations and people in them who complain that they're making change for change's sake. And it's not always needed. So I go into organizations and I focus on change. And I also focus on continuity or what not to change. But we can talk about that in a little bit. But the issue is it needed to be competitive in the marketplace? Is it needed to retain talent and recruit new talent in the organization? Is it needed to set you up for success in the future? And these are the kind of questions that if you don't answer yes to these, then you need to reconsider why it is you're changing in the first place. One of the books that I wrote, Jack, was on You Don't Have to Do It Alone, How to Involve Others to Get Things Done. So I'm a big guy in favor of engagement. I think there's lots of advantages to engaging people and creating their collective future. However, in that book, the very first chapter we had was, is involvement needed in the first place? Mm-hmm. And so we said, you know, the bar's got to be high enough for you to reach out and involve people because it, you know, it's difficult, it's time consuming, it can be frustrating. You know, there are a lot of downsides or difficulties to involving people, just like downsides and difficulties to change. So you've got to make sure that it's going to fit your business model and your competitive advantage in the marketplace in order to take it on. My experience has been, and especially these days with the number of changes and how quickly they're coming, that answer for most organizations is, yes, the change is needed. And the question is, how can we do it best?
Sure. So in that response, Jake, you'd mentioned how to rely on others, quote unquote, and how to involve people. And in my own ERP organizational work, I often share the value of training organizations on building relationships and demonstrating trustworthiness and constructive conflict across the individual stakeholder groups. And in fact, in your book, in which you're a contributing author, titled for our listeners, The Change Handbook, the definitive resource on today's best methods for engaging whole systems, you shared insight in terms of involving large groups and collective participation. And in my view, in ERP organizational change, this is a significant and key influence to the success as many stakeholder groups exist, right? Several dynamics exist between these different stakeholder groups. Can you provide some practical insight on removing barriers or silos between these various organizational stakeholder groups?
Sure. So you can get the technology right in the world of ERP. Everybody knows this. And you get the people equation wrong and you don't get credit. You know, it doesn't count because you haven't succeeded with implementation, no matter how well the technology is designed and brought into the organization. So here's a very concrete example. A lot of people who resist change, and ERP implementation is a very good example of this, resist it because they say, what's in it for me? What's the payoff for me in making this change? You want me to do business in new ways. What's in it that I'm going to gain in the long run that I should bother with this? And a lot of folks who work in the world of change see this as a selfish perspective. They're sort of like, you know, why are you worried about yourself? In fact, you know, in organizations I work, they love acronyms. And so they talk about WIFM, which is what's in it for me is an acronym. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard that before,
yeah,
but
right.
I hear it a lot. So what's in it for me? People see this as like an issue that needs to be resolved. And so the way they deal with it is they try and create a case for change, very popular term, and then they try and convince people that the change is needed. And I think that this is a flawed paradigm. I think that, first of all, what's in it for me is a healthy human reaction to change. You know, what is the benefit for me? If I don't see a benefit for change in whatever work is being called for from me, then I'm one of those people who says, then you shouldn't change. Yeah. Like, unless you've got a good reason, you shouldn't get on that bus and start riding. And people look at this and they say, well, but it's a problem about what's in it for me. And I say, look, there's a different way to deal with this. And a lever or an action that I recommend in the book to deal with this, what's in it for me, is called develop a future people want to call their own. And so when you create a compelling future, people want to make it real. So think about this, right? Rather than the individual and a problem-solving orientation to try and convince somebody, which tends to have them dig their heels in, what we do is we look to the future instead of the past, and we look at the collective instead of the individual. So if I have a future that's exciting, that's engaging, that's going to have me winning in the marketplace, in my career, in my teaming with other people, I'm excited to create that future. So I'm no longer worried about what's in it for me. I can see what's in it for me. I can experience that. And it's motivating. So this issue of the resistance that comes from individuals, I think you need to look at it with a fresh lens and say, no, what can we create together and have that be the focus of your energy? And also, like you said, you got to do it together. You got to involve people in creating that future. Because if I tell you, listen, I've got a great future for you. Let me tell you what it is and let me sell you on it. You're in a sales mode. And even people who say, well, we got to get buy-in. I even have issues with that phrase because buy-in means somebody selling something. Mm-hmm. And if I have to sell you on the change or on the future that we're getting, you're already in the hole. You're already digging your way out because selling people things that they don't want to buy is no business to be in.
Jake, I didn't think I could enjoy this conversation more after your first answer to Jack, and I found myself surprised because I'm loving everything you're saying. The conversation took a turn for me here, and I want to highlight it for our listeners. So change management is often, how do we approach the what's in it for me and the selling and supporting resistance. And Jake, what I'm hearing here from you is we need to change the paradigm to how can I involve others when appropriate in creating their own future? And so going from what's in it for me to how can I see myself in this so that I want to go there? And so the act of selling falls away.
Yep.
When done right, you actually prevent resistance from forming because you don't need to sell.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. And I'll tell you what, so much time is spent building these cases for change and trying to convince people that the way they're believing is wrong, right? I mean, basically, you're saying you don't get it and I know better than you. And, you know, it's no way to go, you know, there was a scene in Animal House. I don't know if any of your listeners remember that movie, but John Belushi was in it. And there's a scene with Dean Wormer, and that this is the guy who's in charge of the school. And he looks at one of the students and he goes, you know, fat, dumb, and happy is no way to go through life, young man. And, you know, I look at this and I say, you know, trying to sell people something they don't want to buy is no way to go through life. And I mean, it's frustrating for both, you know, the person who's trying to sell and the person that you want to buy. It's frustrating for both, and it doesn't move things forward. And there are ways to behave and ways to approach change that are in this book about faster, easier, and better. And that's the answer. And a different paradigm, as I said, looking at some of these issues is the best path to get there.
And Jake, this is exactly what we're going to turn to now. So in my own work, I call that paradigm shift moving from change management to change leadership.
Yeah.
And the key piece there is the process orientation around not selling, but allowing people to realize their own vision in what they're trying to create. And so I want to now turn to the book, because one of the great challenges I've seen in almost any change effort is this recognition of time and effort required when it comes to large scale transformations. I often talk to leaders who say, I want this done in 2 years, and the scale of the transformation is everything about their business. And so what do you see as possible levers when we're dealing with how to get up when we've determined the problem's big enough, the change is big enough?
Yeah.
How do we get people to not buy in, but to align to the future they want to create? And what does it take for leaders to be able to hold that space?
Yeah. So when I have a leader, and I would suggest when you or anybody else has a leader that says, you know, I want to get this done in 2 years, my answer to that is, would you mind if we get it done in one? Now, how is that possible, right? I mean, of course, it gets a lot of people's attention, but how is that possible? Well, the levers each deal with the problem. And one of the problems with change is it takes too long. And so people are missing opportunities in the marketplace. They're missing ways to meet customer needs, all kinds of problems from things taking too long. So there's a lever that looks at the future from an entirely different perspective. So let me explain what I mean by that. Most of us, right, look at the future as something that's going to occur at a later point in time. We're in the present and we will wait for the future to unfold. So if I set a 2-year timeline, the best that's going to happen is I'm going to wait 2 years. What I have is a lever that says, think and act as if the future were now. Now, what that means in very practical terms is you got to have a vision of what you want, right? There's a whole chapter in the book on results, because if you don't get your results right, then you can get faster, easier, better failure, right? Because the levers will get you faster, easier, better, but you got to have the right results. So let's assume that you get that vision right. Then you need to start thinking and acting as if that future were today. So here's an example. You want to have a participative organization. And this is a real story from a client of mine. They wanted a more participative organization, and they were meeting to take a look at a sales strategy in a new market. And the leadership team met in the morning, and they sort of argued back and forth. They came up with two solutions, and they couldn't settle on one of them. And I said at lunch, I said, listen, if you had that participative culture that you're talking about creating, if it were present right here and right now, if you thought and act as if that future were here, how would you behave differently? Like, what different decisions would you make? Who would be in the room? How would you do business in that future if you were living it today? And I mean, the list came fast and furious. They were like, well, look, other people would be in the room. We'd have these salespeople. The people in the new region would be here. We would be making decisions based on what our growth strategy was, not today's performance. They had a whole list of things. So I said, look, this afternoon, let's think and act as if that future were now. Let's get these people in the room. And they were like, well, we've got a meeting next week set up for this. Can we do it then? And I said, no. This is about now, here, today, doing business differently. And so we invited those people into the meeting. Some came face-to-face, some came on video, some came on the phone, but we got them in the room and we got a different answer. By those people participating, not only did they live the future culture that they were talking about, but they got a better answer because they had that information in the room. And one of the benefits of this is that when people, I call it a believability index. When people look around at change, they're sort of like, is it a this too shall pass situation? You know, is this change going to stick or is it going to go back to the way we've always done things? And when you get people, multiple people in an organization thinking and acting as if the future were now, now you're starting to get a critical mass of people behaving in that way that they desire for the future. So when I look left and right at my colleagues, they're doing business in new ways, in better ways that we talked about doing in the future. So I can't argue that this isn't happening, that this isn't real. I can look right around at the people working on the left and right of me, and I can see them starting to do business in the way that we said we wanted. So it increases people's confidence in the change effort as well. And this is perfect for ERP implementation. You can look at it and you can say, well, what does this look like when it's implemented? Not everything has to be done that way. But boy, the more of it that you can do, the better off you'll be.
Jake, I couldn't agree more. In my work, we call this leadership modeling. And so you model the future you're trying to create as you're creating it. And I can't think of a better lever and KPI for change. Jack?
Yeah. Hey, Jake, you've probably heard the phrase that one bad apple can spoil a bushel.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And especially in large scale ERP organizational change, and that needs to be managed, as you alluded to in your response to Jonathan's question. In fact, you mentioned on your website that people struggle with change, they complain it's hard, it takes too long, it's too costly, and so forth. But isn't there always something to learn from stakeholders highly resistant to change? You also share on your website, Jake, that listening to resistant troublemakers is vital to gaining widespread and deep commitment to your effort. So how exactly can you, as you discuss in chapter 6 of your book, actually develop a future where people want to call it their own? You know, if there's a high initial resistance to change, how can you address that proactively? Can you share more?
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm going to even take it a step further. And this also came from this You Don't Have to Do It Alone book. But not only do you have to, I think, listen to these people who we call troublemakers, but you actually have to learn to love them, right? You got to show them some love because these people have been put down for ages in organizations. They get explained away as worse things than troublemakers. The kind of things that we shouldn't even be saying on a podcast is the names that these people get attached to them. And I think that it is another flawed paradigm. These people who cause you the most grief are the ones who can add the most value. And why is that? It's because they're paying attention to things that you're not. So that person who's in a meeting and like raising one more issue just when you thought you had consensus, or asking one more question just when you finish the presentation and it's time to close up the meeting, these are the people that are most valuable to your change work. And if you can learn to love these folks, you know, I say in the book that there are four magic words that leaders can learn and they can use, especially when the hair goes up on the back of your neck. I mean, especially when your patience has been pushed to the limit and, you know, you're ready to just say, shut up and do what I say. It's like when you're raising kids. Of course, when I grew up, like my mom said, you know, why do I have to do this? And she said, because I said so. And it's like, okay, well, there's been a lot of research. That's not a great answer. And it's no better in your organization. But boy, do you want to say it sometimes. It's like you're just fed up with these people. It's like, why? Because I said so. Well, if you can learn to love your troublemakers, these four magic words are, could you say more? And what that does is it becomes an invitation to the other person to share their thinking. It's a welcoming way to have them join the conversation. And rather than them going underground and talking about it after the meeting, which is the worst, or just holding it to themselves and not saying anything because they were slapped around the last time and, you know, they weren't affirmed for bringing it up. Could you say more are the simplest words that I know. And I give these as counsel to, we have a group consultation program that I run around leverage change. So leaders of different change efforts in the same organization. And we practice this, could you say more? And they come back from the work in the organization to these meetings that we hold. And they're like, unbelievable. You wouldn't believe what happened when I just said those four words. Like, we opened up a whole, the dam broke on information in this meeting, and people opened up that were quiet and had seemed to be going along with things. All of a sudden, there was a lot more energy. And yeah, it was a little difficult to control, but guess what? Having it out of control because you're getting too much good information that's going to help you with your strategy, that's the kind of control that I want to lose.
Jake, as I'm listening to the conversation, I'm struck because a lot of the principles you're bringing out strike me as very similar to conscious change leadership by Dean and Linda Anderson.
Good friends of mine.
Yeah, I study their work and I think they're fantastic. And I'm bringing them up because one of the areas where transformations generally fail in my experience is the lack of attention paid to organizational's mindset and cultural needs, and usually they're covert. And I'm so curious, how in leverage change do you involve organizational mindset and culture needs to make them overt and to give the tools needed to address them and leverage them for success?
Yeah. So I was just talking with a client about this yesterday. So I love this question because, see, I believe that each organization is unique. And their history around change is unique. So some of the things that they've done in the past that have worked really well in one organization would never fly in another one. So there's a lever to deal with this called design it yourself. And what that means is each organization plans their own purpose, outcomes, and roadmap for their change work. And that roadmap can be informed by not only their experience, but our experience as consultants as well, to be able to bring best practices to them. But that idea about, hey, we've got to focus on this exact issues that are present in this organization. See, I'm one of those people who say no two change efforts should ever look alike.
Yeah,
because no two organizations and no two situations are ever alike. So having people design their own change effort means that you automatically get it consistent with their culture because they're the ones designing it. So a lot of this fit and finish that people have and rejection of it's not invented here, we don't want to do it, comes from them not being engaged in designing their own path forward.
Continuing on this design your own change effort, and one of the things Jack and I talk about a lot is that lack of considering culture is probably one of the, if not the biggest mistake that change projects make. And it's the number one contributor to failures, both of transformations and mergers and acquisitions. I'm curious, what would you tell leaders to do or how to see in order to address culture from both a process, a people, and the content of a change perspective?
Yeah, so I agree with you that this is a big issue. In fact, and Harvard did a study in just 2019. They said between 70 and 90% of mergers and acquisitions fail because of a cultural issue. So when you're talking about change work, I think we've addressed that in terms of, well, in your own organization, you've got to design it yourself. And if you design it yourself with people from that organization, you're going to bake in your own culture right into the process. But when you're dealing with a merger or you're dealing with a new technology like ERP, that you're putting this into the system, then the existing culture has to accept this new way of doing business. It's almost like a not self cell in the human body. It gets, you know, rejected. So what I believe is that you've got to understand what that culture is, and you've got to respect it, and you've got to see it as a helpful enabler to the work that you're doing. A lot of people look at culture and they say, well, it's a change resistant culture and we've got an issue with that and we're going to have to push this through. It's like, no, let's step back and let's study and understand this culture. We had a merger and acquisition project and we did a whole cultural analysis before we even started the work. And we understood that both of these organizations had very different cultures. So when we integrated them, we were able to articulate exactly what those cultures were and what needed integration already and what had already been part of a shared culture that they already had. So understanding what you're working on is the first step in making sure that you take advantage of the culture rather than seeing it as a sticking point or a problem.
Great insight. So Jake, you've shared some meaningful and insightful ideas from your book during our conversation today. So now I'd like to ask a favor, if you would please. In summary, can you state for our listeners your 8 levers that you discuss in your book? And yeah. Then, of course, I encourage our listeners to buy the book to learn more, and we'll include in our show notes a link to your book. But once you do that, I'd like to pick one specifically and have you share that one a little more detail with our listeners.
Sure. So I'm going to say there are problems and levers. So there's a problem people deal with too much change, like change fatigue. And the counterintuitive approach is rather than doing less change, right? What you need to do is pay attention to continuity. So the more you can pay attention to the way things need to continue, the easier it is to deal with more change. This change taking too long is another one. We covered that lever about think and act as if the future were now. Another problem is this not invented here syndrome. Like, you know, have you ever done this at my organization and my function and the size of organization? All of that gets dealt with by this design it yourself lever. Yeah. And then there's another problem where people don't know enough to make good decisions. So there's a lever we designed called create a common database. And this is about sharing information. And what happens with that is alignment comes along for free. When you get reasonable people the same information, they come up with reasonably the same conclusions. Now, there's another one that says, well, all change efforts have to start from the top. And other people say from the bottom. And what leverage change says is start where there's impact and follow the energy. So where is it going to make the biggest difference to start your change work? That's where to start it, not where somebody who wrote a book that doesn't know your organization or your situation. And then this what's in it for me is about developing the future people want to call their own. And the last two, one of them is that people do their day job, the routine work of their day job every day. And that's great and that's helpful, but finding opportunities for people to make a meaningful difference is really critical so that they can step up and make a difference in the future of the organization. Then finally, people's plates are already full. Every organization suffers from this. And the way to deal with that from a leverage change standpoint is what we call make change work part of daily work.
Really insightful. And I really appreciated your book, Jake. And again, highly recommend it. It's such a fun and insightful read. But do me a favor. One chapter that I enjoyed every chapter, but one chapter that I thought was quite interesting was your chapter 5, as you had mentioned, that start with impact, follow the energy. Can you maybe just take another minute and dive into that one specifically for our listeners, please?
Sure. Sure. So start with impact means that where is it going to make the biggest difference? Now, I've started change work in organizations, you know, with an 80-person problem solving session in a 10,000-person organization. And it's like most people would say, why are you bothering? Like, what impact is it going to make? Well, that's where the opportunity was. And what we were able to do was prove that you could work in large groups. Now, this turned into a 2-year change effort that was written up in Business Week and Fortune. So when I say start with impact, you got to figure out what that is in your organization. Sometimes it's the easiest things and you can get what people call quick wins. But see, I believe strategic wins is what you really want. And a strategic win sometimes might be starting with the toughest nut to crack. And so that's where impact is. You got to answer that question for your own organization. And then follow the energy is, where does the work want to happen? Where does that river cut in through the organization? And where is the water flowing? So it may be people who are like, you know what, they're the most resistant, but there's energy in resistance. So sometimes going where the energy is going to be the best thing. And then also you find that there are people who are zealots and they're waiting for things to move forward and you can build momentum. So this is one that you've got to wrestle with and talk about in your organization, with your leaders, with other people in the organization to figure out, well, where is their impact and where is the energy? But, you know, don't just start at the top because that's what the books say. You got to start where it's right for your business and your change work.
What amazing insight. Jake, this is my favorite question to ask, and I'm really excited to hear your insight on it. If you had to distill down your experience, your expertise, challenges, and the way you see into 4 or 5 sentences of advice for our listeners, whether change practitioners, PE professionals, ERP researchers, and ERP implementation people, what would your advice be? And what would you tell them to be, to do, and to see?
So I've got 5 tips and advice that I would offer here. Number one, embrace change. It's coming anyway. You've got to deal with it. So meet it head on and reach out and grab hold of it rather than letting it wash over you. And have an organization that learns to embrace change, that becomes a change-able organization, one that can manage change and lead change, as you said. Number two, challenge your existing assumptions and what I call the common wisdom. These levers are uncommon wisdom. When you say there's too much change, and I tell you, we'll start paying attention to continuity, that's a counterintuitive approach. So challenge the assumptions you've got because you're not going to get from here to there doing business as usual. You've got to find different ways. Like, could you take 2 years and make them 1 year? Have a clear vision of the future is number three. If you don't know where you're going, you can get there faster, easier, and better, but it may not be a place that you want to be. So a clear vision of the future. I just was talking with some clients yesterday about this, and I said, you know, until you define that vision, we shouldn't do any other work. Number four, engage people in the change work. The more people that you get engaged in the change work, the bigger your team is. And the lighter the load is to carry for each person by engaging them. And that, you know, we talked about this. That's the troublemakers, the zealots and the cynics alike, right? And the last one is listen. Listen to what people are saying. It's, you know, it's so easy when you're at the top of the hierarchy for people to go quiet and listen to you. And you can end up not meaning to dominate a meeting and you're the only one talking because no one else will. So sit back, ask some questions, listen to what people are saying, invite them into the dialogue. And that would be number 5 for me.
Jake, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate your work and insight. And for our listeners, please check out JakeJacobsConsulting.com. Jake, can you tell our listeners how else they may be able to get in touch with you?
Sure. One thing on the website I want to point out to people, when you go there, there's a gift waiting, right? And this gift is a gift that we'll keep on giving. For each lever, what I've done is written a short ebook, but for each lever, there are 3 or 4 concrete actions that you can take. You put these levers to work for you and you have them start building a return on your investment and then go buy the book. So they're very simple things. Like, for example, if you have somebody who's resisting your change work, go find that person, ask them why they're resisting, and see if along with that person, you can address the issue. So it's not something that you've got to work on your own or you've got to try and confront. It's like find out what the situation is and then collaborate in solving it. So when you go to the website, grab the ebook. The other thing that I'll do is invite people to connect with me on LinkedIn. And so it's Robert Jake Jacobs on LinkedIn. And I do 2-minute videos. I drop at least a couple of them a week, which are both entertaining and educational. So I just take basic things in my life. Here's one example. My parents are 91 and 86. So I drive them everywhere. And, you know, groceries, haircuts, doctor's appointments. And when I talk about this on LinkedIn, what I say is it's a different kind of driving. When people drive change in organizations, there seem to be like ones who push it through, ones that you count on to make a difference. You know, you got to stand up and have people follow you. But the kind of driving I do with my parents is different. It's about driving where other people want to go. So it's never my agenda when I go somewhere with my parents. It's always about where they want to go. And I use these kind of basic everyday situations to say, what kind of driver are you in your organization? Are you willing to drive where other people are willing to go as well as where you want to go? So on LinkedIn, I welcome you to find me, connect with me, and you'll see these 2-minute videos and other things that I put up there.
Great. And we'll be sure to include Jake's social media links in our show notes as well. Jake, thank you again. We really appreciate it. Be well, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bye for now.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of the ERP OCJ podcast. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change successes and challenges. We discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change by drawing on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience. We are incredibly grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us in our podcast as we seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community and contribute to its success by bringing research and practice closer together. We want to make sure this is the most useful and insightful ERP podcast you listen to, and we'd love your help in doing so by leaving us feedback and a review. A great place to do so is at Apple Podcasts. Just click on the Listen in Apple Podcasts link, then click Ratings and Reviews, and let us know your thoughts. You can get more info about the show, including show notes and episode highlights for this and all of our episodes, by visiting nesselandassociates.com and clicking the podcast option. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media, hashtag the ERP OCJ. Thanks again for listening. Have a fantastic week.